This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Here in studio with me is Scott Spies, and we're going to be taking questions in just a moment. The number to call, if you'd like to call in here and talk with Scott, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. And that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you give us a call. We'll just take as many questions as we can. And I know Scott will do his best to help you out. Welcome back.
Thanks. Morning, David. Glad to have you.
I don't know if there's anything in particular we want to talk about. I'm sure now it's been cold enough so that people, probably most everybody, unless they're really rugged, have had their furnace on at some point. So they got some sense. Is that going the way that it should? Anything in particular furnace related you just might want to mention?
Well, make sure you got a good clean filter in there. Once we do change from our cooling season to our heating season, it's a good time to change that filter, and probably need to do that a couple of times during the heating season. Actually, what I was going to touch on, since we did have a quick temperature drop here in the last couple of days, I want to let people know that it is not uncommon or unusual to have just a little bit of moisture condensation at the bottom of some of those windows. Now, ideally, the house is dry enough that that shouldn't occur, but if you do have a little bit of moisture, it's usually an indication that the house was damp from the warmer weather. Then we get a sudden temperature drop, and the windows being the coldest place in the house, we will get just a little bit of moisture condensation, particularly right at the bottom of the windows. If you've got that, you can turn a bathroom fan on or something for half the day, a couple hours, try and pulse that moisture and humidity out. As our air dries out, as we get into our cooler temperatures and the outside humidity levels drop, that moisture condensation should go away. If it doesn't, then we need to figure out why we've got a moisture source or moisture supply in the house that's creating that problem.
Yeah, and that could just be an issue of you're not running your bathroom vent when you shower. It may be that if people have kitchen vents, then vent to the outside. I don't know how many people do, but they should be thinking about that. Also, something you might want to think about there is just making sure that the vents from your if you have a gas water heater or if you have a furnace that burns natural gas, you need to make sure that that's venting properly.
Well, hopefully those are venting properly. We do have the state law saying we have to have carbon monoxide detectors. So if a furnace or water heater were not venting properly, your carbon monoxide detector would most likely go off. Generally, what I find when there's a little bit of condensation on the windows is, again, we have a warm, humid day, then we have a very sudden temperature drop, so the windows get colder. But it can also be due to damp crawl space. Something of that nature. Now, when you get a little bit of condensation on that window, you have to remember that moisture, once it becomes a water vapor, kind of equalizes through the house. So if we have a cold spot, that water will tend to condense on there. But the windows aren't the coldest spot. It's actually the attic, which is above the insulation. And so you can end up with frost or condensation in the attic. So if you've got moisture on the windows for more than a couple of days, and then we really need to look into it to make sure we're not getting some moisture problems up in the attic areas as well, which can shorten the life of the shingles or even delaminate some roof sheathing.
So that was going to be my next question. Well, why is that necessarily a problem?
Well, ideally, the attic should have enough ventilation to where the condensation does not collect on the sheathing. It gets enough air movement that it dries back out. But a high humidity level in the house will create a condensation issue in an attic, and you can get delamination of roof sheathing over extended periods of time. We can get mold and mildew growing up in the attic areas. And also it can create problems with the shingles. So that little bit of moisture on the windows, now I normally don't like to see it, but occasionally, and I've already had two calls this morning about, hey, where's this water coming from? When we have these quick temperature drops, it's not unusual, but if it lasts more than a couple of days, then it's something we need to look into a little bit farther.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the things that we've talked about a lot over the years is the issue of attic ventilation. If you were having a moisture issue in some of that, because it does essentially, it circulates through the entire house, anywhere that air will go, it can carry the moisture with it.
Actually, water will move according to vapor pressure, so it has nothing to do with airflow. It will actually push through walls, floors, doors, etc. The only thing that will prevent that moisture from moving is a plastic vapor barrier. And we usually try and recommend one of those on the crawl space area to keep the moisture coming up out of the ground. Most home construction nowadays does have some type of vapor barrier behind the drywall. So we have tried to eliminate the moisture moving up into the attic areas, but I see an awful lot of them that don't have it on the ceiling, so that water can move right through that ceiling up into the attic area.
Mm. Okay. And if your attic has the ventilation that it should, will that help with that?
Well, definitely. It'll help reduce the amount of condensation we get in the attic because we get some airflow movement through there. But I've seen an awful lot of people mistake condensation in the attic as being only an attic problem. Yes, if you don't have enough ventilation, we'll get condensation, and ventilation will usually help correct that. But basically, if we have the high humidity content in the house, we've got to figure out where that moisture is coming from rather than just ventilate the attic. If it's coming from I found a water pipe in a crawl space that was broken that was creating a problem. They were ventilating their attic to get rid of extra humidity when they were actually spraying water from a dishwasher hose down in the crawl space. So it was creating the moisture problem. So, yeah, ventilation is a necessary thing, but if we've got a lot of condensation, it's time to start looking for moisture sources.
All right. We had a couple of calls here ready to go. Hank. No, that's the dad. Scott, this is the son. Scott Spies is the guest here. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here once a month on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance issues, and if you got a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some callers ready, and they're both in Urbana. The first one is on line one. Hello.
Hello. I've got a problem with a shower enclosure. It was a bathtub, and I put paneling. It's sort of a fiber back with I'm not sure what it is, plastic or something on the water repellent on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there was a little nick or something at the bottom of one panel, and the water has gotten in, and of course osmosis, it works up, and the surface is peeling off. And I'm wondering how to repair that. Can I cut that out and then patch the seam with silicone, or do I need to take the entire panel out?
Well, the product you're working with is basically a masonite paneling with a vinyl or a plastic coating over the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes for a good tub surround, but it's not what I'd like to consider a good shower surround, in that any nick or any pinhole in it will allow some moisture to get in behind it. And once the fiberboard starts to get, or the masonite starts getting damp, it causes it to swell. There is no good cure. I mean, where you've got a nick in it, if you were to seal it up, I've seen people put a paint sealer on there, a paint for a sealer. You can use silicone. It's not a particularly durable shower material.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where it works for several years, but as soon as that water starts wicking into it, it starts decaying pretty quickly.
Well, the rest of it's been in place about 15 years without any trouble. But it's probably a foot by 4 feet, and it's at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, there was a pinprick or something that let water get through, and it's doing exactly as you said.
Yeah, and particularly at the bottom edge, where once it starts moving, it kind of lifts that plastic film and gives that capillary attraction a chance to suck some water up into that bottom edge. Yes, you could replace it with – you could cut it out and replace it. You would have, of course, a seam that you're going to have to seal very well to prevent water from getting up inside of it again.
With silicone
Yes, yeah, that would work well. I mean, when it's clean, if you put a silicone sealer, make sure it says it's a mildew-resistant type sealer.
Okay.
Because straight silicone will grow mold, and mildew were probably better than what you could in a Petri dish.
Mm-hmm.
It just has enough pores in it that it holds the water, and so that the mold and mildew really gets going in it well. So you want to use one that's got some algicide in it, something to help reduce the mold and mildew growth. So it says usually mildew-resistant right on the tube.
That's interesting. I'm going to have to replace a tile enclosure in the basement on another shower stall. Actually, when they put it in, apparently they didn't put the furring close enough together, and I sort of lost my balance and leaned against it, and the drywall cracked.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then the tile came loose. What would be a better material to replace that with?
Rather than using like the masonite board or the the press board with vinyl to what you had. They do make a solid vinyl product.
They do.
Yeah, it's very similar in workability, but it is made of solid vinyl rather than of press board, and so it is definitely a waterproof material. You still have to make sure that you seal all the seams and such, but water cannot get into it. They one that's a little bit harder to work with. They make one that's a little more rigid. It's a fiberglass board with a smooth face over it. It's a little harder to work with in cutting and such than what the vinyl is, but it's, like I say, a little bit more rigid. So if you didn't have a good backer behind it, it would support itself a little bit better.
What would you cut that with? pardon me, I'm having a little trouble here this morning. I have used a circular saw with an abrasive disc for cutting fiberglass roofing, for instance. Would that work well?
On the glass board, yes, I think that would work pretty well. Well, that would be probably a better solution than using a fine-tooth saw blade, because you'll end up with a lot less chipping at the edges.
Yeah, it seems to work pretty well. And then, of course, I imagine you use some sort of an edge...
They've got some type of trim panel that you can slide them into to create the corners and such, yes.
Yeah, like with the fiber board material. So I might find that best to replace the one in the basement, and perhaps the long term that would be better in the shower stall upstairs.
Depending on the look you're looking for, that fiber, the glass board or that solid vinyl board will work. The other thing is the cultured marble panels. Now, they're a little bit more expensive, but they're usually a little bit more decorative and tend to help with the resale of the house. They look like a marble panel, but they're actually a plastic panel that you end up getting going here in town and taking your measurements, and they custom build the panels for you.
I see, and then you can install it yourself.
Yeah, they're about a half an inch thick or just a little bit bigger, so they're definitely a lot more to work with. It's more of a – I usually refer to that to more the professional rather than do-it-yourselfer, because it is just a little bit harder to work with than what the smaller panels are.
So there is a vinyl panel, there's a fiberglass panel, and then there's the marble.
The cultured marble, yes.
Cultured marble type.
Yep, those are the ones that I recommend because they have the fewest seams. I mean, the ceramic tile looks nice, but with ceramic tile, if you don't stay on the grout joints, if you're not careful with the seam between the tub and the tile, we can get water in behind it.
Yes, and there's more maintenance to that. It looks nice, but doesn't seem to be the way to go. Well, thanks
all
so
right.
much.
Well, thank you.
Very good.
Bye.
Let's go on to another caller, someone also in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. Okay. I have a water problem, too, but it's about my hot water heater tank. And I was gone for a while and didn't use... any water at all, of course. But then when I came back and attempted to get hot water to flow into the sink, and then I went and checked in the shower, too, and the same thing happened. The hot water would come in a short pressurized burst and then diminish to a trickle, and it would keep running, but a very diminished flow. And I wondered, and then I went over to the tank itself, and I got the same result when I opened up the little, spigot at the bottom to drain out whatever sediment might be there. Some sediment did come out, but the water came out quickly at first for about, 5 seconds, and then it just trickled out. So I'm wondering, I maybe need a new tank.
Probably not the tank itself. It's probably the supply line to the tank. If you have a restricted pipe, let's say we've got a quarter inch even line, you've got a valve. If that valve is either partially closed or has had some corrosion, it'll let the pressure in the tank build up. In Champaign-Urbana, our city water pressure is about 60 pounds. It'll bring the pressure up to the 60 pounds. And as soon as you open a valve and take that pressure off, we're not getting any water back into the tank fast enough to maintain that pressure. So we end up with a pressure drop. So my guess is it's a restriction in the supply line to the tank and not the actual tank itself.
Yeah. I mean, the cold water pressure is fine.
Yeah. Right. I would be checking at the shutoff valve at the top of the water heater to make sure it is fully open. And if it is fully open and we're not getting a flow, then I would probably try and close it and then reopen it, make sure there's not something stuck in the valve. Other than that, my guess is you've probably got some type of restriction in that water line going into the tank. I doubt that it's actually the tank itself.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah, thank you.
Sure,
right,
thank you.
Good. Thank you. And again, to another caller. This is line 3 and someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We built a house a couple of years ago, and we put in a clear stream. Yeah. And after about 2 years, I noticed there was bubbles coming up out of the lawn, and the pipe from the compressor had broken. And we had a technician come out to diagnose that, and then he told us that we didn't have to. He said not to worry about it. He turned off the compressor, and he said not to worry about it. Doesn't matter if it's on or it's off. And then he also said something about, I said, well, do we need to have the tank serviced? And he said, just wait until the alarm goes off. What are your thoughts on that?
I would probably try and call somebody different. I will have to admit that the Clearstream, the jet aeration, and the many sewage treatment systems are not my area of expertise. I deal with them occasionally. Obviously, Champaign-Urbana is where I do most of my inspections. We've got all the city sewer, but I do run into them. Basically, what it is those type of systems are a miniature sewage treatment system. A septic tank uses an anaerobic bacteria to help dissolve the solids, whereas the system you've got is an aerated, where we use an aerobic bacteria. And I like to compare it to the fish tank. If we're not putting enough bubbles in there to keep the bacteria alive, we end up with a low bacteria level, and therefore we lose some of the decomposition properties of the system. So it does have a requirement of having a bubbler or a compressor system to help supply the air and keep it well aerated, keep it circulated, so that this aerobic bacteria can grow and feed on the solids and decompose things. I know that there is a small holding area. I know that there's a filter sock in there, and usually if the filter starts blocking up, then the alarm does go off. Usually I like to see somebody get in a maintenance contract with one of the companies where they come out and check it about once a year, just to make sure that everything is working in proper condition. But for somebody to tell me that the compressor system on an aerobic system does not need to be operating, I question that very strongly.
All right. Okay. And then the thing is, well, the alarm thing has some validity, though.
Yes, if the alarm goes off, it's an indication that we've got a blockage somewhere. It's usually not oh, my gosh, I got to have somebody within the next 20 minutes, but it's something that you want to call somebody fairly quickly to get them there within a week or so, so the system doesn't fill up on you, so we don't get too much sediment in there.
All right. So I should get that bubbler going then.
But I think, yeah, in order to have the proper amount of bacteria in the tank to do the decomposition, we've got to have an airflow for it, because we're not using the same bacteria we are in a septic system.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
And again, next caller is going to be someone in Lafayette, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I have two symptoms, I guess you could say, that we'll see how you diagnose. One is a buzz, a gentle buzz in the pipes in the basement. I can't locate the source of the sound whenever the toilet is concluding its cycle.
Okay. It's going to be in the fill valve in the toilet. What's happening is you're getting a fluttering of something. One of the rubber gaskets or something in the valve is fluctuating a little bit, and you're getting basically a sound transmission. Since water is a hydraulic fluid, you can't compress it. So when you try and open and shut the valve very quickly, we get the water moving, then try and stop it. It kind of creates a little a back pressure. So it's in the toilet valve itself. The valve is got something that's fluttering in there, which will give you your buzz in your entire water line. It'll transfer the sound all the way through the pipes.
Okay. The other is a mild tingle when I touch them in the lamps flanking both sides of the mirror in the bathroom.
Okay, I'm not quite sure I understand that.
Well, you put your hand up there,
uh-huh,
and you feel it tingle slightly with the touch.
Like electric current?
Electrical,
you mean?
Current, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's time to get an electrician. What my guess is that the lamp system is not a grounded system. What age house are we looking at here?
Well, it's 50 years.
Yeah. My guess is the electrical system's not grounded and something has happened where we've got a little bit of a current running to the metal frame and you are completing the circuit, which is what's giving you that little shock.
It's no shock, but I just notice feeling it buzz slightly.
Yeah. It's definitely an electrical leak of some sort. In other words, we've got a very minute charge to the metal casing. It's definitely something that I would get an electrician. My guess, with a home that old, we've probably got some wiring in there and we've got some insulation issue or some insulation on the wiring issues. In other words, a cloth-covered wire or an older plastic-covered wire with a slight crack in it. We're getting a little bit of, for lack of a better term, a little bit of electrical leakage that is then going to the junction box and into the light switch or light casings themselves. It can get worse. So it's something that I would call an electrician and have them check out. They may have to run a ground wire to it to ground it to make sure that we don't have any issues because it could be a potentially dangerous situation if we get a little bit more current to those fixtures.
Okay. I heard you mention maintenance contract and was a little surprised. I'll just ask in closing, what is your feeling toward maintenance contract generally? Are they worthwhile on certain appliances?
Well, the reason I said maintenance contract on the septic system is because that is a constantly running system, and it is something that they do actually have to get in there and clean out some filter socks, so there is a general maintenance. On items, maintenance contracts on items that don't require normal maintenance, I'm not so sure is such a it kind of depends on your mechanical ability. for most items, I do not purchase maintenance contracts on, particularly when I go to the stores and buy electronic equipment. I figure if it doesn't last for 3 years, that probably it's outdated by that time anyway. So it's kind of a blanket question. Maintenance contracts in general, no, I don't do a lot with. But for the septic systems, I do recommend them because it is a good idea to keep them cleaned out in order to keep them working effectively and so we don't end up with any sewage backups or any expensive maintenance to do to the system later.
Okay. We've been at our mid-break here in this hour of Focus 580. Have another caller, and I'm sure we'll get some others. If folks who are listening have home maintenance questions, you can call in and talk with our guest, Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always on Monday. We've been doing these programs for a very long time, and it's one of a kind of a set of things that we do on Focus 580 that's really aimed at answering nuts and bolts questions of daily life. We also try to do shows that will keep you in touch with politics, with economics, with the arts, with American history, with a lot of different kinds of things. We hope that by listening to the program, you get practical advice on shows like this and that you get a little bit better understanding of the world. We're just trying to do our little bit. Obviously, there are a lot of news sources that are required for that. If this program is an important part of your daily routine, and in fact, if AM 580 is an important part of your daily routine, we hope that you will support it with a financial contribution because that's where most of the money comes from to make the programs here. So we hope that you would take the opportunity to give us a call. You can call us at 217-244-9455, or you can go online to willpledge.org. Either way, your contribution means a lot to us. Martha Deal, she's one of the producers for Focus 580, and her contribution means a lot to me in this program.
Thank you, David. We talked earlier about your money being an investment in WILL, and I want you to think about your money in another way just for a second. Maybe you've had a home maintenance problem and you've called in and you've been relieved to find out it wasn't as dire as you thought it was and wasn't going to cost you as much, and then maybe it's gone the other way as well. But if you think of this program as a helpful program and WILL as a great community service, please point your browser to willpledge.org to make your contribution. Or make that phone call, 217-244-9455, but support WILL right now with your gift. Many listeners are making a gift of $120 a year, and that's just $10 a month. Use Visa, MasterCard, or American Express. Your contribution is essential for AM 580.
There are a lot of services that are important in your life. There's your telephone. There's your cable TV. You may have newspapers or magazines. You may have some combination of all those sorts of things. And they send you bills every month. Well, we can't do that. But we'd hope that you would think about WYLL kind of in the same way. Think about it as a kind of a subscription. And maybe you can do $10 a month, which is probably a lot less than you pay for a lot of these other things. Maybe if you listen to WYLL every day, maybe you might think about a dollar a day. A dollar a day won't buy you very much, but it will help keep this station strong and the programs here that you appreciate. So that's just what we're asking, is everybody will do their little bit. And if everybody do that, we'd have plenty of money and we wouldn't have any difficulty. And we're only going to be here today and tomorrow asking for your support. So if you haven't yet done it, we hope you will. 217-244-9455, or go to our pledge site. That's Will Pledge, WILLPledge.org, and we appreciate it. This morning, our guest is Scott Spies. He's taking questions on home maintenance, something we do here on the program every month. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we'll get back to the phones here and talk with someone in Wellington. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, we have a crawl space under part of our house, and my husband I've been kicking around a couple things, and we just thought we'd ask for a professional opinion on them. One, I think I've heard you say that on crawl spaces that have dirt floors that to put down like plastic to make a vapor barrier. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Well, we have never done that, so that's probably a good step for us. The two other options were, what would happen if because some of the foundation has cracks in that, and we've tuck-pointed to a certain degree. But if we would run that plastic up the sides to, like, the joists, or if we would put, like, styrofoam on the inside of the foundation walls.
Okay, well, let me just say that my idea of an ideal crawl space is one that has a full plastic vapor barrier over the top of the soil surface so that any moisture that's in the soil or any moisture that comes through the foundation does not get into the house. Insulating the perimeter walls, the outside walls, is a highly recommended procedure, particularly, and this is for most houses, if you've got ductwork in that crawl space area. Now, occasionally we run into houses that have ductwork overhead, or we end up with some electric homes with baseboards, and those would actually work well to have some insulation in the floor joists themselves, an unfaced or non-paper-backed, so it does not provide a vapor barrier. But for most houses where we have our ductwork going through the crawl space, yes, I like to see at least a 2-inch polystyrene insulation board, usually from the sill plate down about 2 feet, and then some fiberglass insulation stuffed up into the band joist areas.
Okay. So in other words, what might be good is to run this plastic up to the joist and then over the floor up to the other side, and then put the styrofoam on the inside of that?
Actually, I do it the other way around. Usually what I recommend is that you apply the polystyrene board. Now, preferably not the bead board, not the stuff right. that breaks apart, but like the blue board or the pink board, which is actually a chemically formed board. Glue it on the wall. Usually I like to see it go down about 8 to 10 inches below the grade level. You can buy it in a 2-foot width, and for most foundations, that'll do fine. You put it, that's basically the top 3 blocks. Once you've glued it or adhered the foam board to the foundation wall, then you can take your plastic vapor barrier and lap it up to that foam board. And the recommendation I've been making is to buy some roofing felt nails. They've got a plastic cap on it, what they call cap nails, and just use it as like a thumbtack, and you can hold it right onto the styrofoam so you can get your plastic lapped up there. You don't need to put one every 2 feet. You can probably get by with every 3 or 4 feet. It doesn't have to be sealed or locked to the styrofoam, just something to hold it. That way, anytime we get any moisture coming through the foundation wall, that moisture is automatically underneath our vapor barrier, and it soaks back down into the soil where it belongs.
Okay, one quick follow-up question is, this town is kind of notorious for termites. Do they eat styrofoam? I mean, we sprayed our house outside diligently so that we don't have them, but that doesn't mean from year to year we don't see swarms of them in the area,
right?
And we're pretty vigilant about it. So we're kind of careful about what we put in contact with the ground. ground?
Well, that's a very valid question. To the best of my knowledge, termites do not actually eat the styrofoam. However, I have found where they can go through it and use it for nesting. Since it does hold moisture, they can chew through it and tunnel and even nest in it, because a termite wants to stay wet. They don't like to be exposed to air at any point in time. They dry out. And in order to stay alive and healthy, they must stay inside something that was basically encapsulates them. And the foam board can be a nesting situation or a travel tube for them to get up into the house. Now, they are looking for wet wood, so as long as we keep everything in the house dry, we've got a good vapor barrier so we don't get condensation in the band joist areas, good flashing around windows and doors so we don't have leaks underneath the sliding door and such, they should not be attracted to the house. But once we do have a leakage problem or something that is rotting and attracting the termites, then yes, they can come up through the foam.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your information.
All right, thank you for the call. And the next person in line here would be in Champaign, and that's line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, my question is, I have a 60-year-old house, and it's got the original ductwork in the basement. And I've had it recommended to me to replace that ductwork with the round, tubular, kind of the slinky-looking stuff, and I wondered if that would help any on the energy efficiency.
On a basement, in my opinion, not really.
Okay.
The metal ductwork does have a little bit more air loss, because every time we have a joint, there's a possibility we can get a little air movement through there. They do make some ceiling tapes. Generally speaking, duct tape does not work particularly well on ducts. It's good for everything else, but ducts is not necessarily one of the best things for it. They do
right,
make
they
a
have that regular tape.
They've got a foil tape, a metal tape that works out really well to seal up some of those joints. The reason I say I don't feel that as long as we have a basement situation that it's that critical is that any heat loss from the ductwork in the basement, first of all, helps warm the basement, because most basements have very few air supply ducts. And second of all, hot air rises, so the warm air in the basement released does come up and warm the floors above it. So it kind of works its way up through the house. So if we were looking at an attic area, then yes, that might be a different story, because we don't want to lose that heat up into an area where it doesn't come back to the house. But when we're looking at a basement area, I don't think that the duct work is quite as critical. Now, if you have problems getting heat to certain areas of the house, in other words, we've got a low volume and the duct the farthest away from the furnace doesn't seem to be getting enough air, then yes, by sealing up the system, we can get a little bit more volume. But you can also do the same thing with bumping up the fan speed a little bit, or adding a booster fan, and or putting some of this metal tape around all the joints and just sealing up the duct work you've got.
Okay, that sounds like a plan. Can I ask a quick second question?
Sure, sure.
Okay, I have my house also has no overhang on it, and I have there's five windows that are there's nice Pella windows, but they're the casement, and with no overhang, when it rains and everything, and you have those windows open at all, the water just comes right in, and now they are there's a lot of condensation on the windows, which I know they're getting wet and they're rotting, and should I just replace those with the double hung since I have no overhang?
Well, just about any window, if it's open and it's raining without an overhang, we're going to get some moisture come through there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a good one. I don't think I've run into that where you say it's actually coming into the window to the where it's rotting. It's
well, yeah. So could that mean it's rotting just because maybe I haven't taken care of it over the years on the top where the water's falling down as far as caulking? I guess what I'm asking is, can these windows be saved, or do I have to replace them?
Well, depending on how bad the deterioration has gotten on the windows, it's very possible we might be able to go ahead and save them. They do make some penetrating epoxy two-part systems that you can put on the wood that soak in and re-harden and save soft wood. And now if it's rotted and it's got holes in it, then no, there's not going to be much we can do with it. Usually on, particularly on the name brand windows, the Pella and the Anderson and the top end, they've got a pretty good flashing system over the top to help reduce the amount of moisture getting in around them. But again, with a no overhang situation, we can get a little bit more, moisture. Not sure that I can fix that one without actually taking a look at it and see what we've got.
Seems like they're rotting at the bottom seal, not at the top. Like where maybe the aluminum, casing around the outside. has come apart, and the wood inside there is rotting.
Okay. How old are the windows, do you know?
Well, they're at least probably 15 years old.
You might want to try checking with the Pella Window Company. They most of the time they have a very good product, but occasionally they've had some that have had a little bit of an issue. I know I just ran into one the other day that they're doing some work on. For the most part, don't have a lot of problems, but you might check with an actual Pella window rep and see if they'd be interested in sending somebody out to take a look and give you some advice on that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Next caller is Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about raised flower beds. They have this new material. It's composite board, cement, and wood chips or something of that sort. Would that be suitable for the container or bed?
The cement, like a hardy plank type board.
Right.
That's a good question. I'm not sure that it would work well. I'll be honest. I've never used it for something like that. The problem with the most concrete boards is being a slight masonry product. It's basically what you've got is a fiberglass reinforced thin concrete. And anytime you keep concrete damp for long periods of time, we can start to dissolve some of the lime and salts out of the mortar mix, and it can deteriorate. Particularly when we use the fine particles. Like if you put a driveway down and you over trowel it and you get too many of the fines, too many of the small stuff up to the top, then we can get some known as spalling. We get some freezing underneath it. So the concrete board will last for a while, but unless you've got really good drainage in that flower bed, my guess is it will deteriorate over the years.
So it's better to go with a treated lumber product.
The treated lumber would work well. I would probably actually seal it with some paint to give it a little bit of additional help.
Okay.
Just to help reduce the amount of moisture getting into it. The concrete boards work well. It's just if it's not drained well, if it doesn't have some sand and gravel on the bottom of it and some type of drain, I think you'll get some deterioration after a few years.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll go on here. And next caller will be in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Sir. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about some wiring. I have a two-conductor system with no grounds, and it occurred to me that instead of replacing all the perfectly good copper 14-gauge two-conductor, would it be possible or code allowed to run an individual ground conductor to each place where you need a ground?
Okay, the electrical code is for new construction, so once you're up and running, there's no code requirement, at least in our area, to ground any of the outlets. So as far as meeting code, well, the two-wire already meets code. If you have some outlets you would like to ground, such as ones where you're going to be running kitchen appliances or computer appliances, yes, it is acceptable to run a ground wire. I like to see them to go back to the box to wire up to the neutral bus, but it is also allowable to run them to a water line, provided the water line has a proper ground and that there is a ground strap across the water meter. That way, if the water meter were out, there is still a ground all the way across the system or through the system.
Right.
But yes, it is acceptable to run individual grounds to different boxes. I know when I purchased my home, it was a 14-2 wire. And I promptly rewired the house, and then when I moved in, I found that I had a total of 6 appliances that needed grounded outlets. So I spent a whole 3 or 4 days rewiring the entire house for 6 items. So generally, you only need to do the ones where, like I say, kitchen appliances such as your microwave, your refrigerator, high current draw type items, it's a good idea to ground. Garage items is not a bad idea because, again, your high current load saws and drill presses, et cetera. Air compressors, whatever you might be doing in the garage, but also ground fault circuit interrupters are recommended. Again, that's something in new construction you'd have to put in, but there are no retroactive code stating we have to put in the ground fault circuit interrupters.
Well, I plan on putting in some of those, and then just, some people before me have put in outlets with the grounding pole, and they're not grounded. So when we had the house inspected, so there's several places I'd like to do that, and I thought, well, it's easy enough to tear out this 14-2 wire, but then it occurred to me, why don't I just run a wire right next to it? you know.
As long as it's just for strictly for a grounding purpose, yes, that is allowable. Okay. Now, the one thing on the 14.2, remember that 14.2 is rated for a maximum overcurrent protection of 15 amps, so they should be connected to 15 ampere breakers or fuses, not 20 or 30 amp breakers
right.
or fuses.
Gotcha.
Doing inspections, that's one of my fun ones. Somebody has changed the 15-amp fuse with a 20-amp fuse because it blew. And it's like, okay, well, if you blew, that means you were actually drawing more current than what that wire is rated for. So I do recommend keeping them properly fused and properly protected. And that number 14 wire is rated for 15 amps.
I understand that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank
thanks.
You.
I'm just curious, as you have gone around and done inspections, have you seen houses that have the three-prong outlets that people are assuming that means those outlets are grounded when, in fact, some of them aren't?
Very often, yeah, particularly after somebody has done a mild kind of a restoration or an update on a home where they pull all the old outlets out and put new ones in when they painted the walls. The old outlets may have had 14 coats of paint on it and they couldn't get plugs in them any longer or something like that. So, yes, and it's very difficult to actually find the two-prong outlets to purchase. And mm-hmm. because of supply and demand, a two-prong outlet may cost you $3, whereas a three-prong the two-prong would be $3, and the three-prong you can get for about 65 cents. So a lot of people do replace them. And ideally, there should be a ground mm-hmm. wire run to, like, say, a water line or back to the service panel. You're not supposed to run the grounds directly to a neutral at the box. They do connect to the neutral bus in the box, but you're not allowed to do it anywhere other than in the main service panel.
Okay. We have a couple of minutes left. We'll try to get the callers that are still hanging on here. Hammond, Illinois is next, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I got a question. I recently bought a house, and it has a tankless water heater in it.
Uh-huh.
And when we're taking a shower, you'll have the temperature set for what you want, you know, and all of a sudden it'll fluctuate and get real cold. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions. I live out in the country, so I have a well. It seems like when the pressure tank or the well kicks on, it does that.
Well, in the tankless systems, they do usually have a rating of a certain amount of temperature increase across the system. In other words, if you have a X temperature going in, it comes out at Y. And if you have a sudden fluctuation in either flow, quantity of water moving through it, you can actually end up with a reduction. Or if you end up with, I know we ran into this problem out in Colorado where the water coming in was cold enough that the instant unit didn't have enough capacity to heat up from 33 degree water. It does well from 50 or 55 degree water, which is what we usually have in this area. So there can be a couple of different things. It just may be the unit is undersized or that you're running a higher pressure through it than that it's intended to be used for. I would have to say that's probably one of the downfalls of the tankless systems is that when you're using it on a well and you do fluctuate, you can end up with a temperature difference. You might try adjusting the pressure on your well to where you don't have quite as much pressure drop.
Okay.
When I'm doing inspections, I'll find wells that are set from, say, 30 pounds to kick on and turn off at 50 or 55. You might try bumping that up to where it kicks on at, say, 40 pounds and kicks back off at 50 or 55, so you don't have quite the drop across it.
Okay, how do you do that then? The pressure in your tank, adjust that then?
It's at the pressure switch on the tank, and generally, there's a spring with a nut on it that you can adjust as
yeah.
how tight the pressure is, and that will either raise or lower your spring pressure as to when it kicks on and when it kicks off.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll try that then.
Okay. Well, we have one more caller here we'll talk with back here in Urbana. This is line three. Hello.
Good morning. You mentioned putting insulation up against the band joist in crawl space.
Yes.
I'm wondering if that promotes condensation on the band joist.
Well, it does make the band joist a little cooler so that if you have moisture in the crawl space, it can do that. I also recommend the vapor barrier. If you have a properly installed vapor barrier, there's no moisture in the crawl space to condense on the band joist. So, yes, it does make the band joist itself cooler.
We've had water that apparently got between sheets and standing on top. So, yeah, there's water.
Well, ideally in the vapor barrier, there should only be one layer so that we can't trap or get stagnant water between between layers. So usually if you put a new one in, I recommend you take the old vapor barrier out. The other trick or other thing that you might want to do is not use a faced fiberglass insulation on that band joist. In other words, not one with a paper backing.
Just use the open, and then at least there will be a little more.
It'll allow the moisture to move out away from there a little bit better.
Move away from the band joist.
Yeah, to dry out. You'll end up with just a little bit of water movement. Because there again, the moisture does not move according to airflow, but it moves according to vapor pressure. So when things dry out, that moisture can move back out of that insulation. But if you do have a regular damp problem in that crawl space, then the band joist insulation is probably the last thing that I would install.
Thank you.
Just to make sure that we don't get that damage.
All right. Well, thank you. And just real quick, this is something that we talked about a lot, to have the vapor barrier in the crawl space. Plastic over – if you have bare dirt, you want plastic over that. And this is not – we're not talking about anything fancy here, right? We're just talking about sheet plastic just laid down on the dirt.
Yeah, usually it's a 4 to 6 mil thick visqueen. If it's a standard crawl space with vents, then you can use the clear plastic. If you've got an area where, let's say, your access to your crawl space is a window, and around that area, you're going to want to use a black plastic because the clear plastic will deteriorate with sunlight, with UV. So you'll need to put in the black plastic, which has a UV resistant dye put in it so that it doesn't deteriorate on you as quickly. So if you've got one that's got a lot of sunlight coming in, and some of the older houses, the access were all windows around the outside, those we need a black plastic for. But for most of the ones where we just have the crawl space vents up in the band joist areas or just below the band joist, and we got the screens on it, we can get by with the clear plastic about 4 to 6 mil.
Okay. Well, there we'll leave it for this time around with the promise that Scott will be back again next month. Scott Spies works with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here monthly for these programs on home maintenance. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, David.